And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. My guest on today's morning show, James Rebanks, is an exceptionally gifted writer from Great Britain with several best-selling books to his credit. Interestingly enough, James Rebanks dropped out of school at the age of 15 and has spent most of his adult life living on and working his grandfather's farm. But at some point, James Rebanks fell in love with books and ultimately resumed his education at none other than Oxford University. He is still living on his grandfather's farm, raising sheep and cattle, and grappling with how to farm in a way that is kind to the earth. He believes that we have a lot to learn from his grandfather's generation, and he writes about that in such beautiful books as The Shepherd's Life, Modern Dispatches from an Ancient Landscape, and Pastoral Song, A Farmer's Journey. His latest book, a memoir called The Place of Tides, tells the extraordinary experience that he had in his mid to late 40s when he found himself feeling restless and wondering about his place in the world. And his journey of exploration and discovery ultimately led him to a tiny remote island off the coast of Norway and to an encounter with a remarkable woman named Anna. The Place of Tides is published by Mariner Books.
The Place of Tides is about me hitting 50, or a little bit sooner in my life, a few years ago, and wondering what it was all about, as many people do when they get to 45, 50, 55. Beginning to be burnt out, beginning to have lost my way a little bit. Some of my ancestors and my parents, my father had vanished. He died. And feeling a little lost and confused and being very tired. And at that time in my life, I went to this place and I met this amazing woman called Anna on the island, who was just what I needed at a certain moment in my life. And we can talk about that more. But that's who I am. I'm a hillbilly farmer who loves what he does, loves what he's from, who's trying to make it relevant for this age. We do a lot of stuff that people would call regenerative agriculture, mending soil, mending ecosystems, looking after rivers around us, and planting lots of trees, trying to get more carbon in the ground. And I also have this strange double life where I write books, and I've had the ridiculous good fortune, Gregory, for people to love my books, which is very strange. And I've been lucky enough to sell way over a million books in 20 different countries, and it's all a little strange for a guy that dropped out of school at 15 who's not supposed to be very clever.
Right, imagine that. I want to just talk for a moment about this intriguing double life of yours that I wonder, I mean, it isn't actually all that hard to imagine somebody in the bucolic beauty of a farm to be inspired to write and to find some lovely corner of the house where you look out the window and are inspired to write all kinds of beautiful things. But I kind of wonder more on a kind of nuts and bolts level what it is like to fold in your life as a writer with also the day-to-day life you have as a farmer. How do those two things, in a sense, work together, live together?
So I have a theory that although there have been lots of farmer writers in the past, my theory is they were either good at one or the other. And I'm thinking of the greats. I'm thinking of... you have Frost, of course, don't you? And we have... he's still alive, and I don't want to disrespect him, but you have Wendell Berry. I'm struggling to think of their names. What tends to be the truth, I don't mean Wendell in this, but the others, tends to be that they're either living on a farm, but really their head is on the books and the writing. So they're a little bit lackadaisical farmers. I think that might have been true of Robert Frost and maybe Henry Williamson, who wrote Tarka the Otter and others like that. They maybe weren't the greatest farmers in the world, because farming is all-consuming. Really good farming is all-consuming. And so is writing. So I think I've taken on the most stupid of juggles of two different careers, because they both take over your head to do them properly. So the the harsh truth is that 90% of my waking hours, daylight hours, I'm thinking about farming. I'm not thinking about my books. And then I have these interludes in my life where I say to everyone around me, I know I'm about to become a slightly less good farmer. I'm going to lose focus now. I'm going to drop the ball. Can you guys, this is family, my wife, my kids now as they're growing up, can you guys cover for me while I become a little bit mentally absent and I focus on this strange thing I do, this writing thing? And then I have periods of a few months where I very intensely start to lock myself away. I still do a few hours farm work every day as part of my duties. But everyone around me knows when James tunes into the books, he tunes out a little bit of the farming and I'll leave a gate open or I'll let the sheep out or something. So, and that's, if I'm honest, that's because I'm ambitious at both. I want to break that theory of mine. I want to be, when I'm old and I die, I'd love it if people said, actually, he was a really good farmer. Like, that man went for it. And I'd love it if they, and perhaps this is pure ego talking, I'd love it when I die if they said, oh, he was a serious writer. He wasn't messing. And so my life is an imperfect juggling of those two daydreams. Yeah.
But isn't juggling fun?
And my first two books, I wrote much of them through the night. I had young kids when I wrote my first book. A lot of it was written at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'm not any longer, but at that time I was delusional enough to think that you could burn the candle at both ends and that I was a machine. Mm. I could power through. I could show everybody what the tough guy could do. And I could pull off this insane hustle. And part of the story of this book that we're going to talk about in a moment is you pay a price for that. If there's any young men or young women listening to this that are powering through, striving, achieving things, but burning the candle at both ends and burning very bright, I'm sorry to tell you, we're not machines. We do burn out, and there comes a point where there's a reckoning for that.
Mm. And you're right. That's so much the story of this extraordinary encounter that you had some years ago. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with best-selling author James Rebanks about his latest book, which is called The Place of Tides. So you tell us early in the book that you were dispatched by your boss, someone named Peter, and sent to a place called the Vega Archipelago. And tell us this person named Peter and in what respect he was your boss and what work you were doing at that point in time, which prompted him to dispatch you to Norway of all places.
So when I was young, I realized that if you wanted to keep your family farm going, you needed another job, a side hustle. And I managed to develop and have for about 10 years quite a successful career off the farm that I could juggle around the farm. My father was still there on the days I wasn't there. And I became, or made myself, or learned through doing it, became an expert on sustainable tourism. And Peter was both my boss and became my friend. He is a very good person. And I don't think he'd mind me mentioning his surname in this context. A guy called Peter Debreen, who I think originally was from New Mexico. I think he lives on the main coast now. And for a long time after this period was a friend. I've a little bit lost touch with him. But his job was slightly hilarious. It was to deal with the growing hundreds of millions or billions of people who are starting to travel around the world, which sometimes is lovely, but often creates massive environmental problems, social problems, economic problems. And he was the person at UNESCO in Paris whose job was to try and help these very precious places, either sort of wilderness places or cultural cities, churches, castles, whatever it was, to cope with this growing flood of all of us around the world. And he had a tiny budget, and he was able to hire sort of freelance colleagues like myself, and he would send us off to places and say, okay, tell me what's going on there, tell me what the mess is, tell me what we could do about this, tell me how it could be better managed. And I was that guy. I was the guy who would ring up and say, okay, I'm sending you to Machu Picchu, you've got 4 days, figure out what the deal is. Or here's this place where tourism's going badly wrong. Tell me what's going wrong there and what we can do about it. And that, my dad was confused. My dad was a farmer. My dad said, how the hell is that a job? And I burst out laughing and said, welcome to the 21st century, Dad. People do have jobs like that. And that was mine. So he was the trigger. He said, look, he may have said something like, the Norwegians are brilliant at everything. Okay, anything to do with government, the Norwegians are brilliant at. Go and see this place with 6,500 islands called the Vega Archipelago. It's a World Heritage Site, and they have this amazing tradition, at least a millennium old tradition, where there's a symbiosis between the men and women there, mostly women, and the wild eider ducks, whereby they make nests for the ducks, they protect them through the nesting season, and then when they take their ducklings back to the sea, they harvest the feathers that they leave in the nest behind and make one of the world's luxurious products. So I jumped on a plane, I went to Norway. I didn't see anything for the first 4 days that was remotely romantic or worth telling you about. I saw PowerPoint presentations. And then on the final day, they said to me, would you like to go out and see the thing that this is all about, where these women are working? And I said, yes, please, like, let's go straight away. And when we got there, I found myself in this edge of the world seascape, very, very strange seascape on the edge of the Arctic Circle. And in the middle of absolutely nowhere, where we're looking back at the whole coastline of Norway, and we're literally looking at rocks only poking out a few meters above the water, there's a woman standing next to a little house who calls this home or her place of work. And she was the most otherworldly person I'd ever met. And I spent an hour with her. I felt like we had a connection. She had those sort of sparkly, mischievous eyes that the best people have. And she was smiling at me, and I thought, I think you like me, don't you? And I think I like you. She showed me what she did, and then I left, and that should have been the end of it. But I actually, for the next few years, while my life carried on being busy, while books happened and all sorts of things happened, successful things happened, all I kept thinking was about this woman. Who was she? What was that about? Why would you go to that place and do that thing? And I just felt like a magnetism to her. I wanted to go back. And then in 2019, I wrote a letter to someone that knew her that I'd been stayed in contact with, saying, could I come back? And she said, yes, you can, but you have to come for the season. You have to come for this season, because I'm struggling with my ill health. This is the last season I'll ever have on this island. And I didn't notice this quite so much, but I later realized it was relevant. Bring your work clothes.
Mm.
And what happened was I was pulled in, I think. The more I think about this, I was pulled in because everyone had told her not to go. A whole life in that place had been one of defiance, of doing something that everybody else thought was the past. And this was her last rodeo. And having some strange Englishman with work boots on who might be able to help you with the physical work was a way to get that last season, to have that last moment. And I was lucky enough to go there, become friends with her, and to share that moment.
Yeah, I love that. When you describe that first time where you are dispatched to the Vega Archipelago, you tell us that everything I knew about Norway could have been written on the side of a cinnamon bun, but my job was to learn fast. I'm just trying to imagine what it would be like to be dispatched, and not just there, but over and over again, probably dispatched to a whole lot of places in which your knowledge about that place and its culture and the issues they were confronting would be probably next to nothing. And yet, how exciting as well to be thrown into that situation again and again. And obviously, there's something about the way you are wired that made you a natural wanting to have those kind of adventures.
Do you know what it nearly always boiled down to? It boiled down to stuff I learned as a kid. So I live in a landscape called the Lake District in the north of England. We have 21 million visitors to a landscape with 13 valleys where 43,000 people live. And 300 families sustain the landscape, farming families. So I grew up knowing what it was like to have a lot of people come into my part of the world, think it was theirs for leisure and cultural reasons, and to feel a little invisible in your own landscape. And what I found when I went to other places, that there were complicated ways to learn about places. There were books you could read. There was things you could find with a Google search or now an AI search. Often what you really needed to do was to find out where the locals hung out and to find a way to talk to the locals. In England, it would be in the pub, maybe. In other cultures, it would be where they eat or where they sit down in the evenings. With a good translator, find some common ground and then ask people straight. Like, what's going on in your life? How's this thing affecting you? What's the good? What's the bad of it? What are you experiencing? And my job was really that simple. Like, when I got to a place, I'm like, okay, where are people? Where's the grown-up, complicated information? And how do I meet the people to really hear this from the ground? And I think my own background, my very own humble background, was a good preparation for that. And also it used to make my colleagues laugh, who many of whom were urban and very well educated. It used to make them laugh that the secret weapon in many rural landscapes was to tell people that you were a farmer yourself.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because when you describe this first encounter with Anna, this old Norwegian woman, that encounter you tell us was roughly an hour long. So it's that first time you met her, it was not a lengthy conversation, and yet it was very powerful. Would you mind if I read just one paragraph from this description? I just love this. You are talking about this time when you're enjoying tea and sugared pancakes and so on. You tell us, you write, after a while, she told everyone else to stay and finish their tea and nodded to me. She took me across the grass to show me the wild eider ducks she had tamed, sitting on fluffy gray nests in a dilapidated collection of old hen huts, barns, and abandoned cow byres. She lifted the wing of one of the broody ducks and showed me the eggs and some ducklings beneath. The birds looked anxious when I moved, but they trusted her. I said they were beautiful, and I told her as best I could about my family's farm at home, that a few days earlier I had been caring for my flock, and a raven had killed a couple of newborn lambs. She nodded gravely, like maybe we were the only people there who understood this kind of thing. I think that speaks to the sense of connection that the two of you had and the things that you cared about most. And I mean, how great that you had this conversation right off the bat, and it confirmed for her and for you that this would perhaps maybe not be the last time you would speak.
That's right. And although we kind of think of ourselves now as being a long way from the land and managing land, the truth is, like, I do a thing when I do book talks to audiences, it doesn't matter. You can do this in Manhattan, you can do this in Paris, you can do this in the middle of nowhere. Put your hands up if you're a farmer. In Manhattan, two hands go up in a big room of people. But if you say, put your hand up if one of your parents was a farmer, a third of the hands go up in the room, even in Manhattan, right? You say, put your hand up if one of your grandparents was a farmer, suddenly everybody's hands are going up all over the place. We're not very far away from being people of the land, people of stone, people of wood, people of soil, people of animals. It's so, so recent in our history. It's part of who most of us are. Not all of us, but most of us. And I think my passion as a writer is to find the people who are still that, but also connect back to the rest of us and go, this is literally your dad, like in Sicily. This is your grandmother in Thailand. And one of the greatest thrills I've ever had, I keep mentioning Manhattan. I did a book talk in Manhattan, I think in 2016, and when my first book came out. And I genuinely thought, no one there is going to relate to this. Who would care about being a shepherd boy? And I had a queue of maybe 100 people after the book talk. I think 99% of them told me that their parents were farmers in Thailand or Sicily or Italy. Everybody has a land-based story in their background. And I think, why does that matter? I was reading some Wordsworth the other day. So I'm from the landscape that gave the world William Wordsworth and the Lake Poets, the Romantic Poets. They believe very strongly that the way we live shapes who we are, and how we live shapes who we are. And I think that as our lives are changing, we're losing connection to some of the values that made us what we were, to some of the ways that we interrelate to one another, to our ways of talking to one another. And I know we're living in this very fast-paced world that's changing with AI and all these other things, but that might only be one step into the future, but you take one step back and we're actually quite simple creatures that were in small groups that lived in villages or rural areas. And I'm just really interested in that, about who we were and what we want to carry forward. How aware do we want to be of where we came from?
And of course, to re-encounter this woman named Anna was for you a way to do that. And as you've already touched on, this is maybe 7 years later, and you found yourself, in a sense, in an unhappier place yourself in terms of some dissatisfaction with what you were spending your time doing, enjoying. You describe some great success professionally, but maybe on a more personal level, feeling rather intense dissatisfaction. You reach out to Anna, asking if you can meet her again, and she, as you've already told us, tells you yes, but you need to come for this entire duck season. I mean, you need to come here and be prepared to work, and this is not going to be just a quick little visit, but a very different encounter. There are a lot of ways in which this is disconcerting for you at the outset, and one of the things you touch on as you first arrive back at Vega is a realization about the matter of language and the fact that, in a sense, you do not speak the same language in probably more ways than one. I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about, especially at the outset, but really even throughout this time you spent with Anna, that matter of language. And for someone who wields words so beautifully as an author, what was it like to suddenly find yourself in an environment where the matter of words was a bit more challenging?
Yeah, so there were two problems. I didn't speak Norwegian. Her English was basic. But there was a second problem, which she was not a particularly wordy or talkative person. In fact, she was the opposite of wordy and talkative. She was quite a self-contained character who's used to being quiet. In fact, her work, looking after these ducks, is really about being quiet, observing things intensely, very small, modest things, and then basically scaring everybody else away who might make noise to destroy that world because it's based on silence or wilderness. But you're right, when I went back, what I found was, and I found this interesting because it related to my other work, I'd invented a woman. I'd invented a slightly white witch type woman who lived on some rocks, who was very, very independent and tough and somehow outside of the world. And I think I wanted that. I thought, okay, I'm a little tired of the real world. It's going crazy. Can I step out like she did? And what happened was I got back there and I met her in her home back on the big island. So not on the little island out where she works, but on the main island. And what I actually met was a grandmother figure, a sort of elderly lady whose health was failing, who lived in a very beautiful but modest Norwegian home. And we looked at each other and I think both of us thought, oh, what have we agreed to do? We're complete strangers and we're about to go on a little boat to a tiny little place in the middle of nowhere. I wonder if this is a good idea. Like, will I destroy everything that's nice about it for you? And it even went through my mind, is this lady going to feel scared of me? I'm a man after all, and she's a lady that's a little bit older, and am I going to break the order of things? So we quite quickly tried to establish the rules of the game, which is that, and I was happy to, that she was the boss. It was her world. I'm there to do what I'm not doing now, which is to shut up, to be a human camera. And I did explain this to her, and I said, I sort of want to be an anthropologist. Let me watch you. Let me follow you. Let me hear you. Let me observe you. And let's try to make this as unmale as I can. I'm going to try and not come in and wreck your world, dominate it, talk over it. And she said, okay, that's great. You want to be an honorary woman. And I said, I would be joyfully happy if you would treat me as that, even if you're pretending, for the next few weeks. And then we met a friend the next day called Ingrid. And when we went to the island, they said, well, if you're going to be an honorary woman, you need to know what's wrong with men. And they gave me a three-week-long lecture. It literally took three weeks to tell me everything that's wrong with men that I needed to know if I was going to be a more effective creature. And what really happened is that they took me... Oh, I nearly used a strange metaphor there, but I think it's true. They took me under their wing.
Mm.
They were the mother ducks, if you like, and I think they sensed that this male duck might have been pretending to be too tough for too long, too solo, too important, and was just a little tired and needed somewhere to rest, not exactly rest because I was working with them, but without ever saying it, without ever discussing it, I think they just sensed James needs us to look after him a little bit. Not in the physical sense, but in the, yeah, you come with us. We'll put you under our wing. You can work with us. You can be part of our world. And there was an incredible kindness and gift in that to me, which I will never forget as long as I live. They turned out to be, yes, ordinary women, in inverted commas, but absolutely wonderful ordinary women who'd lived very real lives, very compromised real lives, where they'd been married, they'd had jobs, they'd had to do what you have to do as a woman in the modern world, and housewives, and Anna had been a cook in an old people's home. But they'd also held on to dreams while they'd gone through that real life of having kids and marriages and things. And part of their dream was that they would do this thing that their grandmothers had done on the islands. And there is something wonderful about people who, yes, have served their term, yes, have paid their dues, yes, have been part of communities and sacrificed part of their life, but at some stage do what they really need to do. Mm. And the amazing thing about Anna was that she'd spent the previous 20 years going back to this island and recreating the world of her grandmother in a way that didn't really pay her very much money, didn't initially get any attention or praise from anybody, but she'd done these remarkable things to bring ducks back from the open sea to this tiny little island to begin to be able to harvest their feathers with a staggering level of stubbornness and persistence against mockery in some quarters. And all of her fights to do that had been quite small, but she'd had to rebel against the woman who was her boss at the old people's home, who didn't think she should be doing that. She'd had to slightly go against common sense, slightly go against the conventions of a small rural community. And latterly, in her old age, when I got there, she was having to defy doctors and people who said, "You're too old for this. Like, this is going to go wrong."
Mm.
And there was a steel there, an absolute steel, which I'd sensed the first time I met her, that she was going to do it anyway.
Mm.
But the more I think about it, I think she'd done a deal with her God. And I think the deal was, let me do one more season. I know it's probably one too far, but let me do one more season, and then I'll leave this place with grace. And I'll go to the other life where I'm a grandma and a mother. And she found it hard. I think she found it hard because this is a very willful person who wanted to carry on. But by the end of that season, she was very graceful. She had lived her dream. She had done her thing, and she was coming to terms with that. And perhaps that's what I was looking for, really looking for, as I hit 50 and I think about being 60 and maybe 70 and 80 if I'm lucky. I think I needed to see somebody who'd work that out.
Mm.
That you have a swing, you do some things that are great, you have some things that go wrong, you have some ups and downs, and you've got to find a way to go through the last part of your life with, and I'm not super old or anything, I'm only 50, maybe some older people will be laughing at me saying this, but you've got to find a way to see the end and then maybe approach it with some grace. That's what I've got figured out.
Right.
And I'm sure it's not easy. I'm sure as I get older and maybe I have ill health, it's harder than it seems right now, but that's what she gave me, that sense that you can fight determinedly for what you believe in, fight for your part of the world, fight to stick up for these things that we care about.
Mm.
And someday that will end. It will end for us too. Mm. And that has to be okay. You know, life's a cycle, right?
It is. Speaking of cycle, I want to be sure that you take a moment to describe to our listeners this thing called duck season, which, of course, if you're watching certain cartoons, means hunting season, where you get to hunt for ducks, and this kind of duck season couldn't be more different. We're talking about a very different sort of relationship between ducks, not adversarial or predatory in any way, but a season in which you are seeking to welcome ducks, these eider ducks, back to this island and to other small islands off the coast of Norway. Describe to our listeners briefly, I'm afraid they can explore your book to kind of experience the richer details, but what needed to happen over the course of this duck season when you, from the time you arrive to sort of the climax when these ducks finally made their return?
So maybe the first thing to say is basically Viking women or pre-Viking women worked out how to do this thing, or men, and what happened was the ducks came to them, okay? So the ducks, eider ducks nest either in busy seabird colonies where there's so many millions of birds that there's chaos and they can nest in the bottom of it in the seaweed and be protected from otters and other wild creatures, or, and the ducks work this out initially, humans are a good proxy. Nesting close to where the humans live or the fishermen's families live stops the otter coming and taking your nest. The otter's too busy worrying about the people. There's a circle of fear, I think ecologists call it. So that's how it started. But if you fast forward from that to the mid-19th century, there are these islands or collections of islands called Vars, like a sea estate is the way I would translate that, where over hundreds of years they've built up nesting duck colonies where each spring the wild birds come in, but there's not 10 ducks, there's 1,500 over some islands that are the size of maybe 3 or 4 football pitches. And they're able to harvest from those nests enough eiderdown to make 2, 3, 4 eiderdown duvets. And this has incredible value, both in the ancient world, in Viking towns, but even in the present day. And by the mid-19th century, these people make themselves, instead of being sort of indentured servants or peasants or serfs out on the edge, they're now people of status and wealth. They call them the feather and down kings and queens. Mm. So you've got this sort of peasant kings and queens, which is what Anna's people had been, which is why she has an outsized stubbornness and pride in what her grandmother was, when in the eyes of the people on the big island, she's low status. These outer islanders were meant to be low status, poor people. And yet her grandfather would turn up to church on the main island with a gold watch and the best suit in the building and would flash the watch out to tell everybody, you think we're the bottom of the tree, we're not. Mm. And so she goes out to do that. So what is the work? The work's really simple. You go out at the end of winter, you drag seaweed with pitchforks up onto the rocks, you turn it each day until you make a kind of dry, crispy seaweed hay. Then you carry it when it's really brittle all around the island, and inside, on the floor of the barn, under the porch floor, in a chicken hut, in a little stone hut, in a wooden shipping container, you make nests for eider ducks before they come. And they're these beautifully handcrafted sort of crowns of a very crisp seaweed, which look like any idiot could make one, but trust me, I was an idiot. And Anna, everyone I made for about 3 weeks, Anna went, no, you're not seeing it properly, you're not doing it properly. And she taught me until I could do that well. So we made 350 nests, and then a duck season basically involves waiting for the ducks to come, which is fearful because the seas are collapsing all around the world. The ecosystems are collapsing and they're not sure if they'll come. But when they do come, they come very quietly at night ashore. They start laying eggs in these nests that we've made. Then after a few days of laying an egg each night, they come and sit on those nests and have to be protected, both protected from predators, but also protect the silence. So they have this time called vantid in Norwegian, where everybody in that part of Norway knows that you're not allowed to flap the sails on your sailboat or go fishing around these islands, or these very fierce women will shoo you away, tell you to go away and protect the ducks. So being a little bit scary is a good idea for a duck woman. And then after 28 days, when the ducks have hatched their ducklings and snuck them off back to the sea without being eaten by seagulls and eagles, you're left with this dirty mass of seaweed. And the rest of the year, or the rest of the season on the island and then back home, is putting the down through harps and these other ancient devices that let the heavy stuff tinkle to the floor and leave the weightless down because of the barbs of the feathers holding into a sort of bob of down, so that somebody can sleep beautifully for the next 100 years in a duvet. Hmm. This is all so that somebody gets to sleep beautifully. That's it in a nutshell. And yeah, just an incredible, incredible tradition. And we love to call things, it's romantic to pretend that she's the last person who will ever do that. It's always the last shepherd, the last duck woman. Books always use that. And I know why, but I think people like me and Anna, when you do those things, you think, no, I'm not the last. I'm the torch carrier. Somebody else takes the torch from me. And we go again. And how dare you think we're the last? Because that's the whole point. We're going to make it. We think this still matters. And the contemporary relevance of this is that in those seas where the ecosystem's collapsing and the seabird colonies are vanishing before our eyes over the last 15 years, the healthiest parts of that ecosystem are where these women are working and where they're the stewards. And that raises some really interesting questions about whether we, when we've wrecked the world, whether we get the hell out of it to let it mend, or whether we're actually part of it. And I'm friends with the amazing American writer Robin Wall Kimmerer, who wrote a book called Braiding Sweetgrass. And she would argue, and I agree with her, that we're absolutely part of nature. We're part of this. We can mend it as well as break it. We can make it more abundant as well as more impoverished. And the lesson of Anna, and the lesson I bring home to my farm every day now is, okay, I'm going to be the good ancestor. I'm going to be the one that makes it more abundant, more healthy, more thriving, more birds, more butterflies, better food. We probably don't have time. I could talk to you for hours about how our food system has become degraded and how we're all eating food that isn't as good as it should be anymore. People like me, people like farmers all over the world, all over America, if we were to change that system, change those values, we can become menders of things. And I don't think we've ever needed that more.
Hmm. One of the things I love about your book is that not only are we learning about this fascinating ancient practice as it is continuing to be done in dwindling numbers, of course, nothing like it was once done. I mean, when it was an immense industry. But this dwindling, fascinating practice of trying to create, in a sense, hospitable places for these beautiful ducks and watching for predators and so on. This book is also deeply personal in the sense that you really describe in riveting detail what it was like for you to be there, and the sense, you've already touched on this, of discomfort that you felt in terms of what exactly was your role to be. And especially right off the bat, when you arrive at this small island and Anna seems so frail, so feeble, hardly able to do anything, and it's actually you and her friend Ingrid who are doing most of the work at the outset, and your relationship with Ingrid is, in your mind, quite tense and frosty for quite some time. And I just appreciate that you realize that this was also an aspect of this story. I mean, this is not just a book about these ducks and this island and so on, but it was a book about what you experienced there as someone visiting a landscape that was in so many ways utterly alien to you, and in particular, what your relationship was going to ultimately be with these two women. At the outset, did you expect that this was going to be such an important part of the experience?
No, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I knew I wanted something from them, and I wanted to be part of their world. But as the days there passed, I began to realize a number of things, one of which was how absolutely manic most of us now are in terms of our attention span, in terms of our need for stimuli. Like literally, you ride a tube train now, or you ride a subway, or you jump on a bus, or you go anywhere. What's everybody doing? They're being highly stimulated as they scroll through their screens, or there's multiple screens chucking stuff at them. And I realized that even though I'm a shepherd and I should technically be outside of that, I'm that too. And that we're mentally overstimulated all of the time. We're mentally doing too much all of the time. And that this woman wasn't, that she was on a different setting. And it was a setting that probably most of our ancestors were on, which was slower, way, way less manic. She was getting her stimuli from quite slow, natural things, the coming and going of the tide, what the birds were doing. And she had a heroic indifference to the modern world for in that early period, particularly. And I remember thinking, oh, this is going to be quite hard. It's almost going to be boring in the modern sense. I'm going to be in this place where I'm not stimulated all the time, where I can't look at my phone because there's no signal or there's no electricity. And I also realized quite quickly that when you don't have that, it comes to get you. It's a little bit like cold turkey, where if you've been a drug addict or something, I was getting the shakes after, like, it sounds exaggerated, but a couple of days in without my phone, I'm like, whoa, this is slow. Like, my brain's going too fast for this place. I need to slow the heck down. And I think that's good for us. And I think we're not seeing quite, I'm beginning to sound, was it Marshall Marshall McLuhan, I can't remember his name was, that wrote the books about how technology changes in our brains. I found myself thinking about him. I thought, oh my God, I'm not just a machine person. I'm a computer person. This stuff's into my brain.
Mm.
And I've become overwired. So I tried to write about that. And then I was also very aware, because I am very bookish, that historically men go to places like that and imprint upon it their own meaning, their own sort of meta-narrative about they're the important thing, their senses are the important thing. And as a writer, I was interested in, could I not do that? Could I make her the important thing? Could I make me the broken thing or the silly thing? Could I try to put the camera on her and say, actually, men that turn up in the middle of nowhere, they're not the authority. They're not the smart. This woman's been there a long time. She knows better than I do. She's tuned into it better than me. Like, let's use that as a mirror back on what's wrong with me, because what's wrong with me is probably what's wrong with you, and what's probably wrong with us is probably what's wrong with everybody, right?
Yeah. So
that's what I was trying to do, and so I guess I also wanted to play with that nature writing genre where something's important because the white middle class guy sees it.
Rick.
I wanted to do the opposite and go, no, maybe it was important before you got there. Maybe it'll be important after you leave.
Right. I think that's what you mean when you write at one point, being on the island was affecting me more than I thought it would. I had always had a lot of control over my life and my days, but here I was in their hands, working at their speed, and as they saw fit, I was having to learn to be smaller and more malleable. This slow day by the fire, a day of listening, was quite unlike my normal life. The clock on the wall had stopped, and no one cared. We were now governed by the rain, the clouds passing over, whatever the seabirds were doing, and the endlessly changing light. But above all, it was the tides that dominated our waking hours.
I loved you reading that. Thank you. And what I would say, and the irony here is that I'm doing it because I'm in an interview about a book and you have to talk quite a lot, but the irony here is I think our civilization says to men, and we've got the most powerful man in the world right now, right, is a model of this. It says to men, you're meant to be the noisy one. You're meant to be the big one. You're meant to be the powerful one, the rich one, the sportsman one, you're meant to be the high-status one dominating every interaction that you have. And I don't think I'm the worst man that ever lived, but I'm definitely a man, and I'm definitely in that mode. And when I got to the island, I thought, okay, I'm going to, for the first time in my life, I'm going to try not to be that. The thing about being smaller, like, it's going to wreck this place if I'm that, because this is a place that two women dominate and control. And I would urge men, maybe when they're listening to this, for the rest of the day, just as an exercise, maybe not be the me that's talking too much right now. Maybe try and be the me that makes yourself smaller. Let the other people around you speak a little more. Let them be a little more. And what you find, I think, in those, when you do that, the most unmale of things, is that you see how talented the people around you are, how smart they are, how you've been stepping on their toes for a long time. You've been dominating conversations you shouldn't have dominated and all that. I'm not saying men are terrible, but that shouldn't be the message. But my message is we might need to rework some of that stuff. Just tone it down a little, make ourselves a little smaller so that everybody else can be a little more themselves.
Right.
I think that's what.
Of course, part of what is also intriguing about Anna's story, and you've already touched on this, is the fact that although this was something that she remembered from her own childhood, this practice, that for quite a period of her adult life, she was not a part of this tradition in the way that, for instance, her grandmother had been. And she, in a sense, reinvented herself at the same age that you are now as you wrote this book, right around the age of 50. And in a sense, that makes it even more admirable what she was able to accomplish, the way in which she chose to take the reins in her life and really seize what was most important. And that's something that probably more of us should have the courage to do.
I think so. And just as you said that, I think maybe one of the comments about my books I'm most proud of is I met a lady a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking to her, and she said, I've read everything you've done from the start. And she said, when I read your books, I feel like you're growing into somebody through them. like each time I get to the end of the book and I think, oh, he grew up a bit through that book. And if that's true, I'm over the moon. Like, I think that's our job. I don't think this idea that we're sort of super finished, like we are a fixed thing, I don't believe that at all. Like, I think you live, you should be learning every day. You should be becoming more aware of what you're not so good at. You should be working on the things you are good at and not so good at. We should all be evolving all the time. We are on a cellular level anyway, right? We're changing all the time. I try to live like that. That's what I believe. And this book's definitely one of those moments where I went, do you know what? I've been living a certain way. And I came back, I was initially a little angry at myself. I said to my wife, have I been wrong? Like, have I lived a good life? And she said, no, like, you're taking it too far. And I had a really good moment about a year after I came back from that, when I was writing the book, where I thought, oh, I forgive that young man. That young man did what he thought was best, what the world told him to do, to get from A to B. He didn't mean to hurt anybody. He didn't mean to be a bit gruff at times. He didn't mean to be a bit pushy. I forgive him. But I'm also not going to be him forever either. Like, I'm going to be somebody else. I'm going to work at being better than that. I know a bit of stuff now that he didn't know. I forgive him his flaws, and let's go to the next stage. And that's what I'm working on. Yeah. Mm. And Anna was a brilliant role model for that.
Absolutely. As she herself sort of came to know at one point in her life when she chose to make this dramatic change, our lives are a series of choices about what we do and don't do. Over time, we decide what to let go of, what must die, and what we will fight to keep alive. Sometimes these are big, deliberate decisions. Other times, change happens in 1,000 thoughtless little moments. Lying in her bed one night, the choice came to Anna, already made. The someone who had to do that work was her. She knew it wouldn't be easy. There would be a price to pay. There always was when you change things. But she did it anyway. The story of Anna, so extraordinary, and your own story as well, told so beautifully in this extraordinary book, The Place of Tides, published by Mariner Books, the author James Rebanks. James Rebanks, I can't remember the last time I was more powerfully moved or more deeply engrossed by a book. And I learned so much and was moved to think about my own life in a lot of different ways. And I'm sure everybody who takes up this book and opens themselves to it will be similarly moved. So I thank you for that, and I thank you for the privilege of speaking with you today on The Morning Show. It was an honor and pleasure.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the respect you show me and my work, and I hope everybody listening has a great day. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, in a departure from our published schedule, I'm going to be replaying a conversation from 10 years ago with Linda Fleshinsky, who for many years was a co-host of our program Education Matters, and for many years a wonderful columnist for the Racine Journal-Times. Some of her best columns are collected together into a book that we will be talking about, In What Light There Is. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. On Friday, for Pride Month, we will be talking with Robert Trachtenberg about his book, When I Knew, and also talking with writer Christopher Lee, the son of best-selling author Ann Lee, about his most recent queer novel. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today is going to be a mostly cloudy day, and we have a pretty decent chance of showers and thunderstorms for much of the day. With today's high temperature right around 75 degrees, more showers and thunderstorms are possible tonight. About a 20% chance this evening. So fingers crossed that the Kenosha Pops Band will still be able to play tonight at Pinoyer Park. Overnight low of 62 degrees. Lingering showers are also possible in the forecast for both Thursday and Friday. Temperatures in the mid to upper 80s. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine.